Welcome to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Oman, Assistant Professor at William & Mary Law School. You can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com. Just look on the left side of the page under the Categories heading and click on Law Talk. There you can find past episodes as well as information on how to subscribe. My guest today is Professor Daniel Markovitz of the Yale Law School. Daniel teaches and writes in a variety of areas, including the theory of toleration and the philosophy of contract law. This episode, we discuss his theory of contracts and how it can be applied to the issue of contracts of adhesion. Well, thank you for agreeing to come on Law Talk with me today. What can you tell us about your theory of contract? You have not an idiosyncratic, but a unique take on the nature of contractual obligation that you laid out a couple of years ago in the Yale Law Journal. How, if you were to summarize that in a paragraph or so, how would you summarize it?
Great. Well, listen, thanks very much for having me. And I suppose the first thing I'd say is that traditional views of contract view our contractual practice principally as a form of wealth creation, which seeks to serve the material interests of the parties and possibly third parties. Whereas I understand contract as at least also and perhaps principally a form of social integration, which seeks to allow and in fact encourage persons who share little, no interests or few interests and few points of view about the general interest, nevertheless to act together in respectful and collaborative fashions.
Now, some contract theorists have tried to come up with theories of contract which are not primarily premised on wealth creation. Here I'm thinking about the works of someone like Charles Fried or Randy Barnett. How would you distinguish your notion of collaboration from a notion of the moral obligation to keep a promise or the consensual transfer of rights?
Good, that's very helpful. So let's take a look actually at both their theories, and let's lump them together somewhat inaccurately, but nevertheless I think helpfully in this respect. They're individualist theories of contractual morality. So in Fried's case, the idea is that certain types of promissory practice maximize the freedom of people by enabling them to plan, to be relied on, and therefore to make long-term plans that are possible only when others rely on them. My view is different. My view is that what contracts do is they establish a certain relation between the parties. In particular, it's a relation of respect, and the hard part in the theory like mine is to explain how there could be respect, even though, let's say, sellers and buyers have competing interests and view each other instrumentally. Sellers want high prices, buyers want low prices. The basic idea is that it's a precondition, philosophers would say a transcendental condition, of making a contractual promise to another person, that you respect that person as the type of creature that's capable of receiving a promise. We don't promise to animals, we don't promise to things. And moreover, in law, traditionally, we haven't been able to promise to other degraded classes of citizens, say women and slaves. So there are very real direct ways in which the capacity to receive, not just to make, but also to receive contractual promises, is a sign that the legal system respects the person.
Now, it would seem that your theory would be complicated by the fact that traditionally the laws recognize the ability to make promises to or receive promises from artificial persons like corporations. How would you deal with the fact of corporations as collaborators in contracts?
Yes, good. So I think there are two things to say. One thing I'm confident of, the other thing I'm less confident of, but believe to be more important. The confident thing to say is there's no reason why not to separate domains and to say that contract for individuals is one domain of contract law and contracts for entities and corporations are another domain. And the right theory of each of these is separate.
So this would be something like the argument that Robert Scott and Alan Schwartz
and Scott make, right? Okay. The thing that's a perfectly intellectually honorable thing to do, but not really so helpful because somebody who has a view like mine doesn't want to cede the bulk of what people traditionally think of as contractual activity to the instrumental or other views, but rather wants to try to make a broader claim, trying to reclaim some of what others have focused on for the kind of humanist approach that I prefer. And I think there, what I want to say is the following. The corporate form itself can be viewed as a type of social integration. And when people make contracts and receive contracts as agents for corporations, although they are not personally liable under the contracts, nevertheless, they enter into relations with each other that are quite similar to the contractual relations that natural persons enter into when they make contracts. Although corporations are clearly forms of wealth generation also, I think it's a mistake, again, to view them as only that, or even possibly principally that. One of the things that the law enables when it creates the corporate form or recognizes organizations generally is it enables individuals to strike relations with one another that they couldn't strike if they were acting exclusively on their own behalf. And it's a mistake to cede corporate law, contracts involving corporations to theories that view corporations as simply pass-through entities only for the shareholders. And one should instead think of the law of contracts governing corporations as a body of law that makes it possible for people to act together as representatives of other entities, namely the corporations for which they work.
It seems that this is a view that's obviously different from, but there are certain echoes here, right, of the notion of, it seems to me, the notion of a corporation as a nexus of contracts, which is obviously an idea originally from economic theory, but it's the notion, right, that there's more going on in corporations than simply agency costs or maximizing value for shareholders. But you've got lots of stakeholders who are sort of voluntarily entering into relations with
form. That's very helpful. Let me try to use that to be a little more precise along the lines of what I was saying earlier. Look, one thing that the corporation is itself a collection of contracts among various persons who are shareholders, employees, customers, and so on and so forth. And those contracts can be integrative. So one of the ways in which the many individuals coordinate their activity in a society is by entering into these complicated contracts. And the corporation can be thought of as the holder of residual discretion. But it's also the case that the corporation allows those who are involved with it in one way or another. Let's focus on employees for the moment. It's agents, not just any employee, but it's agents, those who contract on its behalf, to make arrangements with other natural persons who are contracting on behalf of other natural of other corporations that these two natural persons could not afford to make on their own. So that there's a sense in which it's a little bit like the integrative analogy to limited liability. Right? What limited liability does is it allows the owners of corporations to take risks they couldn't take on their own behalf if they were personally liable for the outcome.
How is this different? Go ahead.
What my view wants to say about contracts between agents of corporations is that the corporate form gives people opportunities to go out into the world and engage in much richer and denser webs of interconnection and collaboration with other agents than they could do if they didn't have the enormous support structure that the corporation consists of.
And on your view, it's those respectful interactions with others, those sort of pro-social effects of contracts, which is what makes contracting inherently valuable, if you will, as opposed to any purely instrumental view of maximizing one's power or wealth in the world.
Yes, that's right. And I take that view for two reasons. First of all, I am more impressed than others are with the pro-social and integrative nature of contracts. So here's an example. Most people think contracts are basically ways of adjudicating conflicts of interest. The question is, how should the surplus be divided between the two parties, and the contract is the result of their bargaining about the division of surplus. My own view is that it's much more important in contracts that contracts adjudicate disagreements about how best to promote the general interest. So what way of arranging the party's affairs maximizes surplus? Take a contract between a homeowner and someone who's in to renovate the house. Most of the negotiations will be about what design is appropriate, what materials are appropriate, what types of workmanship are appropriate. What people mean by appropriate there is what's in the joint interest of the parties. as they arrange their affairs together. Once those things have been set, they'll then negotiate over the price, which has to do with dividing whatever surplus they've managed to create. That's the first way in which I think that contracts are distinctively pro-social. The other has to do with a more philosophical question, which is more interesting to technical specialists in moral philosophy. But there's a real problem of how you can get going the strict liability and forward-looking nature of contractual obligation
right. Without
some foundation that's distinctive. And the existing alternatives having to do with the power of the will, maximizing free agency, or in fact maximizing economic surplus, all fall short of generating these two distinctive features of our contractual practice, namely strict liability and forward-looking obligation. You need something else, and it seems to me the natural other thing to look at is the inherent value of the contract relation.
It seems, though, one could offer arguments for some of those factors on the basis of some sort of second-best theory. So, for example, one might explain the strict liability of contract and say, well, if we were purely concerned with maximizing economic value from contracts, we could say something like, we'll impose liability for negligent breach, where negligence is defined with reference to some notion of economic efficiency. But because we don't believe that courts have the institutional capacity to measure all of those factors well, we think that strict liability is going to encourage parties to negotiate out to more efficient outcomes. Or arguments along these lines.
Sure. I think that's, for example, a particularly strong form of argument with respect to why we have the expectation remedy rather than reliance damages. I accept that. That may be an alternative explanation. It's not going to be a good explanation as an interpretive account of what courts are doing, right? Because it treats the court's rationales as being, in a way, the wrong rationales. The courts purport to be aiming at the expectation remedy, not economic efficiency. Now, that may not be a problem if you have an economic view of the law, in which case you're not terribly inclined anyway to take what courts are doing at face value. You're not interested in the logical structure of doctrine. You're interested in outcomes and the way in which doctrine produces outcomes. And that's fair enough. I don't think that anything that I have to say in my work immediately gainsays that approach to law more generally. But if one's interested in an interpretive and reconstructive approach to legal doctrine, that is to say, in asking the question, what are the basic moral and political principles that are imminent in our legal practice? A second best explanation is unlikely to be very appealing. Moreover, if one can actually find moral and legal principles, moral and political principles that explain precisely the practice we have, wouldn't that be a nice thing?
Yeah, not explaining it in second best terms.
Right, not in second best terms, that show that the practice is the best elaboration of these principles.
Now, you've also been doing work with your collaborative theory of contract on contracts of adhesion, and here I think it's very interesting, because since at least the work of Frederick Kessler in the 40s, we've had various arguments about why contracts of adhesion are wrong, or perhaps are problematic. And the arguments that have been given have traditionally gone to fears about inequality of bargaining power between large institutions and repeat players and discrete individuals, particularly consumers, or alternatively have gone to the fear that, and it's obviously related to the first concern, that the substantive terms of contracts of adhesions are unfair. They tend to resolve all things in favor of the drafting party of the contract. And you have suggested some criticisms of contracts of adhesion that really go off in quite a different direction.
Yes, that's right. I actually think Kessler came closest to seeing the point that I'm trying to make, and that people who followed from him, Rakov, Slauson, actually in a way took a step back. By the way, Kessler was a figure in my youth. He taught my mother.
Oh, really?
And he gave, I think, one of the best notes to try to get a student who was late on a paper to deliver it, which is he sent her a note at the beginning of the summer saying, "You owe me a paper. Could you get it to me quickly? I fear I may not survive the summer."
He
had lived
another
15 years, but she sent him the paper. But look, one of the things that Kessler says at some point, he says, look, contract replaced status as a form of solidarity. And he says contracts of adhesion threaten to undermine this form of solidarity. Now, he doesn't say a whole lot about why. He says something about how they threaten to reintroduce status, which I think is not right. But start from that thought. The contracts of adhesion threaten to undermine contractual solidarity. What might one mean by that? Well, on my view, the natural thing to think is to ask whether contracts of adhesion may, in one way or another, fall short of the form of reciprocal respect, collaboration, joint action, recognition that makes contract integrative in the first place. And it seems that once one poses that question, the answer is yes, in any number of respects. Contracts of adhesion involve no negotiation. They involve no pre-contractual relation. Insofar as one of the ways in which contract integrates is not just by making the fully formed contract relationship integrative, but also by making pre-contractual relations integrative. For example, by recognizing agreements to agree as binding, by creating contractual-like liability based on promissory estoppel. All of those opportunities are abandoned by the adhesion form. Moreover, within a contract, when it comes time for performance, one of the ways in which ordinary contracts are integrative is that the parties mutually adjust over the course of performance. Every contract is underspecified, and so there is ongoing integrative relationships. There are ongoing integrative relationships within the contract as the contract gets performed. Again, contracts of adhesion replace that with a bureaucratic system of administration in which the term maker doesn't try to integrate with individual term takers at all, simply treats them as a bulk and sort of sorts out bad customers from good ones through a process of purely instrumental maximization.
So when I hear your theory, there are sort of two objections to it that come to my mind. The first, and let me throw these out and let me get your response to them. The first, it would seem to me, is that you place a lot of emphasis on the integrative force of bargaining. But it seems to me that oftentimes people use shopping as a substitute for bargaining. So rather than haggling or dickering with people over the terms of a contract, I simply go from one offeror to another offeror to another offeror until I find the person with the term or price that I like, and then there's no haggling of any kind. And it seems to me that there's a lot of contracts that are like that, where really what people are looking at is just what's conveyed in the price term, and then they're shopping rather than haggling. Would you say that the same issues or problems of lack of integrative effect is present in those cases as well?
Yeah, that's very helpful. So one of the consequences, in my view, of contract is that the market is itself an integrative institution. And one of the things you're pointing out is that perfectly competitive markets are not integrative. In perfectly competitive markets, everyone is a term taker. Nobody has any control over any of the terms of their relations. So they're quite isolating, whereas actual markets, which are somewhat imperfect, involve this reciprocal pattern of suggestion, response, engagement that makes them be integrative. Perfectly competitive markets are a little bit like perfect instantaneous direct democracy, in which all people's preferences are instantaneously aggregated on every issue without their engaging each other at all. Again, democracy is an integrative practice, but it's integrative in its departures from that perfect model. Now, an interesting question to ask is the kind of view that I'm proposing simply a lament for a better era of small shareholder civic republicans? Or is it also suited to the modern world in which, after all, large organizations, large economic organizations, bureaucratic administration are here to stay?
Yes. Or you could put it even, you could put the question even more harshly and say, is it a lament for an idealized view that passed?
Yes.
Because it's not as though shopping in relatively competitive markets is something new.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And I think the answer is no, it's not. But it introduces problems, but the problems aren't insoluble. First of all, notice again that there's an analogy here between the democratic process and the market and contracts. Mass democracy with an administrative state has been said to be alienating in exactly the same way in which I am now saying mass contracting with term makers and contracts of adhesion is alienating. So what we might want to do is look to the solutions that have been adopted in connection with the administrative state and see whether there might not be similar solutions available in contract. And I think the answer is yes. There are lots of solutions. There are ways to make even mass contracting more responsive and more integrative. For example, by studying the sociology of customer satisfaction departments and seeing how they can be redesigned to be forms of ex post readjustment at relatively low cost.
That leads nicely into the second thing that it would seem to me one could offer as an objection to your critique, and that is to say, look, when I sign a form contract or some other contract of adhesion and I have written contractual terms, those terms may or may not have all that much to do with my ongoing relationship with the other party. And in fact, we have a pretty rich literature suggesting that in a lot of situations, the contractual terms don't actually matter all that much. Or certainly in the context of an ongoing relationship, people make mutual adjustments, and that the written terms really are about exiting from those relationships. And I think about even in my own experience, for example, I have a credit card from American Express, and to obtain that credit card, I signed a contract of adhesion. But I actually find that in my actual interactions with American Express, the contract has very little to do with the interactions. When there's a problem on my credit card, I call the customer service line, and I've actually never had a problem reversing a charge or getting some other sort of solution. And so the contract that I signed doesn't have all that much to do with the relationship that I entered into by making the contract.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the things a theory like mine does is it gives the law the conceptual resources necessary to explain why, even in the end game, the modes of interaction that constitute your mid-game relations with American Express should determine the terms through which you'll close your relationship with each other. Right? On a traditional view, it's both an autonomy view and an efficiency view. It's hard to get over this thought that the contract of adhesion says what it says, and that at least if there is a well-functioning market for contract terms, people ought to be bound to that. Whereas on my view, it's natural to say, look, the way in which this contract integrates is through establishing a relationship between you and American Express. It does so through your interaction with their customer service department. We need to analyze that relation more carefully than we've done so far, understand the norms that govern it, and apply those norms throughout your experience with them.
So what would you see as the relationship between your theory and the line of relational contract theorists going back to Stuart Macaulay and Ian McNeil?
Good. It's complicated. I confess that I find Ian McNeil in particular difficult to pin down.
You're not the only one.
There are always multiple factors which often seem to me to enter into the argument at different levels of conceptual abstraction. And it's hard for me to know what's driving what. So hopefully I'm clearer, although I don't know if I've been clearer here. But also, one of the features of McNeil's view is that contract and contractual solidarity come second. Pre-contractual social norms come first. One of the consequences of my view is that there is a distinctive form of solidarity associated with contract, with entering into reciprocal legal obligations and giving one another legal authority to command performance. And that the types of norms that arise within ongoing contractual relations should be understood in light of this form of reciprocal respect associated with the creation of the contract. That difference is extremely important for the following reason. If you're going to think of contract as an integrative process, the real thing you want to explain, the reason I'm excited about this line of argument, is the role that contract plays in sustaining cooperation and social solidarity in open cosmopolitan societies. That is to say, in societies in which, but for democracy, and markets, the citizens would share very little in common. And in particular, they wouldn't share the kinds of close relations that a view like McNeil's wants to make the foundation for contract. You need to be able to create contractual solidarity through the contract-making act standing on its own. And that's what the view that I'm starting to elaborate is trying to do.
And it's not dependent on a notion that there are thick background shared norms.
It's in fact,
it's
conjuring trick, in fact, is precisely to show how, even in the absence of those norms, even against the backdrop of background antagonism, the contract relationship is nevertheless respectful and, in fact, collaborative.
So despite the language of collaboration and integration, there's a profoundly liberal philosophical strand to your arguments.
Yes, I think that's right. You know, if you think of what are the basic pillars of liberal legalism, I think there are four. Toleration, that is to say pluralism in some way, a state respect for pluralism. Adjudication, which is to say the rule of law in the application of general standards to settling particular disputes and a participatory form of dispute resolution. Democracy, which is to say collective self-government, and markets, which is to say contract. And so my work on contract is actually one part of a four-part research agenda to try to reveal how each of these pillars of liberal legalism is in fact socially integrative, a form of community, and a form of community that's distinctively suited to open cosmopolitan societies in an effort over the long term to try to pull the rug out from under a series of critics of liberalism who've come up in various related fields over the past 30 years, suggesting that liberalism is alienated, antisocial, that social norms are better, that communitarianism is better than democracy, so on and so forth. And contract, I want to say, is one of the places where we can see that what seems at first like an alienated way of arranging one's affairs is in fact an integrative way.
Your piece on contract and collaboration has already come out. What are the prospects for when your work on adhesion is likely to be published? Where are you at in the writing and researching on this?
The adhesion piece should be done in some version that will come out somewhere, I would say next spring, next year. That's my guess. For this fall's submission cycle or for the spring submission cycle. I have another piece which explains why I'm dissatisfied with existing accounts of contract, which is also out in a symposium on private law and legal theory in the Virginia Law Review. And then I have a long manuscript which explains how my approach integrates the study of contract, democracy, the rule of law, and toleration, which is in draft form, and I don't know when it will come out. The next specifically contract-related arguments will have to do with good faith. And then once the contracts of adhesion piece and the good faith piece are in place, then I think I have enough to put them together into a book, which will be on contract as a means, as a method, or a mode of social integration.
Well, that gives a lot for myself and other contract theory junkies to look forward to. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me today, and I look forward to reading your research when it comes out.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for putting me on.
I'm always interested in your responses to Law Talk. You can email me at nbomann@wm.edu. You've been listening to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. Technical support is provided by William and Mary Law School. Our theme music was written and performed by John Schmidt. You can find more of John's work online at www.johnschmidt.com. That's J-O-N. And you can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com.